Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 272, The Boers Ring Major General Colley's Column at Lang's Neck. Weather is fickle. Of course, nature is just nature, but when you're on high ground in the mountains and the weather moves in, the temperature drops in minutes and the wind shifts. It's a dangerous place, and that's during midsummer. Perhaps summer is the most dangerous time to be caught in a mountain storm, particularly in South Africa, because there's more moisture and freezing sleet and snow that sweeps over the summit, overwhelming hikers that moments ago were in shorts and t-shirts. During January and February 1881, the weather along the Natal Escarpment near Forks Rus and Majuba was characterized by high rainfall, frequent thunderstorms, thick mist, cold nights. The period was at the height of the summer rainy season, creating wet and muddy conditions that significantly impacted military operations during the First Boer War. The weather at times was bitter, just like the Boer sentiment. Lang's Neck gravesite was desecrated in 1969 when Afrikaner nationalists, under cover of dark, blew up a large cross that had been erected over the graves of Royal Navy sailors who'd perished during the Battle of Lang's Neck in February 1881. Such was the depth of historical bitterness. Memories run deep. The last known Boer of the First Anglo-Boer War, Jacob Jaap Kutse, died in the same year as the exploding cross, 1969, showing just how long veterans of war can live amongst a population that has no clue about their past. A vet of the First Anglo-Boer War had lived to hear the Beatles' music. Kutse was 15 years old when he joined Commandant Piet Joubert's commandos in the area of Lang's Neck, and was a survivor of the next major clash, Majuba. Not that Jaap Kutse was in any way linked to the desecration. Lang's Neck lies on the N11, a quick 20-minute drive through this pass, and you ascend from the rolling hills of KZN into the high ground of Mpumalanga, or the Transvaal, as it was in 1881. In January of that year, the British force under Major General Sir George Pomeroy Colley moved off from Newcastle after his ultimatum to the Boers was ignored. George Pomeroy Colley was a product of the mid-Victorian imperial military system, educated, intellectually capable, steeped in the orthodoxies of British warfare at a time when those orthodoxies were beginning to come apart. Born in 1835 and trained at the Royal Military Academy, Woolwich, Colley entered the British Army as an officer of the engineers, a branch that typically attracted some of the army's more analytical minds. He served in southern Africa and India, gaining administrative as well as field experience, and eventually rose to become Governor of Natal and High Commissioner for Southeast Africa. Despite his intelligence and administrative competence, his battlefield record would reveal a critical weakness, a tendency to apply textbook European tactics in environments where they were increasingly obsolete. For him personally, it was a fatal mistake. The Boers, by contrast, were armed with modern Wesley Richards breech-loading rifles and other similar breech-loading firearms, which allowed for faster and more accurate fire than the older muzzle-loading weapons that had shaped earlier British tactics. Many Boers were also skilled marksmen, accustomed to hunting and irregular warfare, and they fought from concealed positions, rocks and ridges and scrub, rather than in formal lines. This combination of mobility, cover and firepower was going to be devastating. Colley led 1,216 officers and men, including five companies of the 58th Regiment, five of the 3rd Battalion of the 60th Rifles, 150 cavalrymen, a party of Royal Navy sailors with 2 7-pound guns, and a mounted unit of Royal Artillery with 4 9-pound guns. Major General Colley was determined to revenge the previous month's debacle at Bronkhorstspruit. As you heard in the previous episode, a British column on the way to relieve Pretoria was stopped by Boers, who ordered them to turn around. The commanding officer of the 94th Regiment, Lieutenant Colonel Philip Anstruther, refused, whereupon the column was devastated by Boer rifle fire. 155 officers and men were killed or wounded. Women who were part of the column were also hit. Colley was shocked when he heard about this, as he awaited reinforcements shipped from India, England and Gibraltar. He decided to march into the Transvaal forthwith, albeit with a fairly small force. A little while back, I bought a book called With the Boers of the Transvaal and the Orange Free State by journalist Charles Norris Newman, which has Colley's official dispatches in its appendix. I also managed to get a copy of Paul Kruger's biography, written by D.W. Kruger, no direct relative apparently, published in 1961. Both are useful sources because they have original documents. Collie wrote in his dispatches that no further reinforcements could reach me for at least 3 weeks, and having regard for the effect of such delay on Pretoria, where the loyal population has had to take refuge in the camp and is undergoing all the miseries of a close siege. He was also worried about his besieged garrison at Potchefstroom, so he decided to move forward at once with the force at my disposal. He admitted he was marching into the unknown. Regarding the Boer forces opposed to me, it was difficult to get reliable information. Captain Lambert of the 2nd Battalion Royal Scots Fusiliers said there were 16,000. He had recently been released by the Boers from a POW camp at Heidelberg. Other local sources said it was more like 5,000 to 7,000, with at least 2,000 at hand on the border. The last bit of information was spot on. Boer Commandant General Piet Joubre led 2,000 men, with 400 of these advancing halfway down Lang's Neck to set up positions alongside the pass. Collie knew they had no artillery, but were flush with ammunition. "And generally excellent shots," he noted ominously. There were three main roads from Newcastle that led into the Transvaal in 1881. They're still there today. One to the right, going to Utrecht with a branch to Wakkerstroom. One in the centre to Wakkerstroom district, and then on to Standerton and Ledenburg. And one on the left, direct to Standerton. Both roads to Wakkerstroom climbed across the Drakensberg Range at elevations of 5,000 to 6,000 feet. The pass directly to Standerton was Lang's Neck, which technically lay inside Natal territory. The Boers set up four main lagers on the escarpment northeast of Majuba. Their main camp was based at a point south of the Standerton Road, about 10 kilometres from Wakkerstroom. From here, flanking the two roads which approached from Newcastle, their patrols could ride out to watch the Buffalo River fords as well as Lang's Neck. Collie moved off from Newcastle on the 24th of January after 2 days of heavy rain held up his wagons. On the 25th, they struggled across the Imbazani River, and on the 26th, crossed the Ngogo River. British patrols saw Boers moving on the pass, and on the evening of the 27th, noted that Lang's Neck was occupied in force. More heavy rain fell that day, and a thick mist drifted across the landscape. On the morning of the 28th, Collie led his force out of the lager, leaving 260 men to defend their temporary base as he set off towards Lang's Neck. Anyone who has driven this pass knows there are two parts to that journey. It lies in the centre of a semicircle of hills, about 8 kilometres long. In the west, there's the lofty square-topped mountain called Majuba. It is marked by precipitous slopes and deep wooded ravines, ending on the eastern side by the Buffalo River, which runs through a rugged gorge. The road skirts the foot of Majuba until it rises at Lang's Neck, re-entering the bend of the semicircle. There are high mountain spurs on the left of the road, and as it passes the neck, there are spurs on both sides. Excellent ground for defenders to lurk. From Lang's Neck, the ground rises on the west, along a series of ridges and shoulders, furrowed with more deeply wooded ravines. In the east, the ground rises sharply to a table hill, which is almost a kilometre long, and this is part of the second half of the pass. And that was the key to the pass, the table section, because it commanded the plains below, and Collie was going to strike at the eastern edge of this table. That was a strenuous 600-foot climb for his men. The column left the main road below the table, crossing a deep valley and moving into an attacking position on the lower range of hills opposite, about 2 kilometres away. By 9 a.m., they were at the bottom of the rise of the neck itself. The 60th were sent off on the left in an extended formation, with the naval brigade with their two rockets, along with the unit of Natal Mounted Police. Ambulances, fortunately, were based in the rear. The main attack commenced on the spurs to the left of the Boers' position, the British right, first with guns shelling the heights and the dongas. The cavalry waited behind the guns. This was classic British assault methodology, used over and over again in wars against Indians, Africans, even Americans. But this wasn't 1812. It was 1881, and the Boers were not going to commit themselves to silly theatrics like direct charges. At 10 a.m., the 58th was ordered to advance on the hill on the right of the neck, and the mounted squadron charged from further east, further to the right, attempting to outflank the enemy. The first troop, led by Major Brownlow, made it to the ridge held by Joubert's men, and that was when they were met with withering fire that emptied about half the saddles. The mounted unit retreated, reformed again lower down, and then, in an act that almost defies logic, charged back up the slope again, still on their horses. The Boers were sheltering behind rocks and picked off the riders with ease. The head-on assault wilted. Bizarrely, the cavalry remained mounted when the obvious approach would have been to dismount and take cover, then perhaps crawl up or down, taking advantage of the terrain. But that's not how these British were trained. While an example of extreme bravery, it was also an example of extreme stupidity. The 58th Infantry, meanwhile, had made its way halfway up the slope without too much loss, but that was about to change. The men were gasping for breath. The steep hillside had tired them out. Then an order for charge was given before they could recover. The slope was graded 1 in 15, which is about as steep a hillside you can get before you're forced to scrabble on hands and knees. The Boers hit them with a terrible volley, while a small party of Joubert's men moved to outflank them from the right. It was a two-minute trial by fire when Colonel Dean yelled, "Charge!" His horse shot out from under him. He clambered back up and said, "I am all right," and then was shot dead. Lieutenant Inman of the 3rd and 60th was also shot down. Major Hingston ordered, "Fix bayonets," and all the officers went forward to encourage the men, but it was hopeless. Many of the 58th were hit fiddling with their bayonets. Somehow, they managed to stagger to the summit of Table Hill, when they were fired on again by Boers concealed in trenches only 150 metres away. All the remaining commanding officers leading the charge, including Major Hingston, were killed. At 11 a.m., the 58th retired as best they could. Very much the mid-Victorian-era commander, Collie was more interested in how the men retreated with valour, many more dying than was necessary, just because they took their time heading back down the slope, as the men of the 60th Regiment tried to provide covering fire. The 58th had fallen back leisurely, without haste or confusion, reformed at the foot of the hill, and marched back into position in as good order, wrote Collie in his dispatches, with an erect and soldierly a bearing as when it marched out. To be shot in the back, gallantly, of course. Whatever his grandiose commentary, the reality was the British had been mauled, defeated. A small party of Boers then advanced from their positions on the lower slopes of nearby Majuba Hill and attacked the naval brigade near the British camp at Mount Prospect. Return fire from the British forced the Boers back. By 11:10, two companies of the 3rd and 60th Rifles had moved up Table Hill to cover the retreat of the 58th Regiment, and by noon, the battle was over. After the engagement, Captain MacGregor rode up to the Boer camp with a flag of truce and asked for permission to recover the dead and wounded. Commandant Piet Joubert, in a gesture that spoke volumes about the complex code of honour that governed this war, sent parties of Boers down to help the British recover their casualties, feeding the wounded brandy and water with a generosity that must have bewildered many a redcoat. Both sides buried their dead together on that same hillside where they had fought so fiercely, though the British officers were afforded a final distinction, their bodies carried back down to Mount Prospect, where they had a full military burial with all the trimmings. The class divide between officers and men was vast. And then, as if the landscape itself wanted the last word, the heavens opened, thunder rolled across the Drakensberg, lightning split the sky, and torrential rains swept down over the battlefield, washing the rocks clean of every last trace of blood and gore. It was, even for those hardened men on both sides, an almost unbearably dramatic conclusion to the most shocking British defeat since St. Luana. The British lost 84 dead, 113 wounded, 2 captured, during what was later to be called a fiasco. Most of the casualties were from the 58th, 74 killed, 101 wounded, around a third of their total strength. And among those killed in the battle were many of General Colley's staff, including Major Poole and Lieutenants Dolphin and Elves and Inman. The Boers suffered only 14 dead, 27 wounded. General Joubert's report, made to the Triumvirate, the three-way leadership back at Heidelberg, was illuminating. He described how he expected the British to attack on the 28th and that they would commit to a direct assault uphill. The infantry, redcoats, stormed and came so near that the dead on both sides fell in amongst each other. One of the officers even fired in amongst our men with his revolver before he was shot, but then the Lord helped us. Where Colley's dispatches had said that artillery fire had not amounted to much, Joubert revealed the opposite. The English cannon was too great, and we suffered heavily. 24 casualties were caused by the artillery, far more than Colley had thought. Joubert explained that he had decided not to counterattack. It would have cost the life of many of our bravest men. The distinct difference between how Joubert and Colley viewed their casualties was illuminating, for the Boers galloping into the mouth of the British artillery did not make sense. Furthermore, a son of our worthy friend Dirk Eis is also amongst those mortally wounded, wrote Joubert. German missionaries Merensky and Scholz treated the Boer wounded. Back in England, steps had already been taken to reinforce the British. Brigadier General Sir Evelyn Wood was appointed second in command. Technically, he was of a higher rank than Colley, but made no complaints, at least publicly. News of the defeat at Lang's Neck swept the country. Wood's appointment was popular. It would be his third visit to South Africa, in what may appear a strange fact to relate, but the Boers would also welcome Wood's appointment, believing that his knowledge of the country would lead to a shorter war and avoid unnecessary bloodshed. The first of the reinforcements from India had actually already arrived in Durban before this battle. The HMS Euphrates, anchored with the 2nd and 60th, and the 15th Hussars, the cavalry, and F Battery of the Royal Artillery on board. Too late to join Colley, however. 5 days later, on the 30th, HMS Crocodile docked. It had also sailed from India, on board the 83rd and 92nd Battalions. A day later, HMS Dido dropped anchor in Durban, landing a naval brigade of her own, along with two Gatling guns and two 24-pound rocket tubes. By February 2, 1881, all of these units were on the move, heading to Newcastle, with a message from Queen Victoria ringing in their ears.
I am deeply grieved at the loss of so many brave officers and men, she said.
The Battle of Lang's Neck was added to an increasingly long list of defeats the British Army had suffered in South Africa. Initially, the Zulu had dealt them a series of defeats, nigh the Boers. The British had to set up another camp on the Biggersburg Range between Ladysmith and Newcastle and formed up a second column to march directly to Sir George Colley. He was in somewhat of a predicament, hemmed in at Mount Prospect. His provisions were running short and his communication with Newcastle almost cut off. Strong parties of Boers penetrated close to Ladysmith and threatened Newcastle from the Utrecht district. They were cutting off convoys, capturing wagons, preventing any post from reaching Mount Prospect. More ships docked in Durban, carrying material, others carrying members of the 97th Regiment from Halifax and Gibraltar. Then news broke in the Cape that the Orange Free State had ordered powder and ammunition from Port Elizabeth. The Cape government refused to grant permits for the purchase, horrified that PE merchants would even consider such a sale, profiting from blood, so to speak. The Boers allowed a convoy of wounded to pass from Mount Prospect to Newcastle in early February, while communication remained hit and miss. They kept cutting the telegraph cable. Colley's mental state, meanwhile, was increasingly fragile, which was going to lead to a terrible miscalculation later in February. While Boer and Britain were squaring up for their fateful clash on the slopes of Majuba, in France, a Parisian activist called Hubertine Auclair had launched La Citoyenne on the 13th of February, 1881. It was a boldly feminist newspaper that dared to demand equal rights for women in the city of so-called Liberté. In the midst of a very masculine European imperial scramble, in the midst of the very masculine Anglo-Boer War, her ideas were like a bolt from Le Bleu. Then, on the 18th of February, Cuban doctor Carlos Finlay stood up at a sanitary conference in Washington, D.C. and dropped a bombshell. It was mosquitoes spreading yellow fever, not bad air or moral weakness. A discovery the world would stubbornly refuse to believe for another 2 decades. Kansas, meanwhile, went completely dry on the 19th of February, becoming the first American state to ban alcohol entirely, which, depending on your sympathies, was either a triumph of virtue or an absolute catastrophe. The world, it seems, had no idea that a rocky hill in Natal was about to change the course of empire 8 days later. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, au revoir.